Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents False Bingo, Stories by Jack Gems, narrated by Julie McKay. Where all are guilty, no one is. Confessions of collective guilt are the best possible safeguard against the discovery of culprits, and the very magnitude of the crime, the best excuse for doing nothing. Hannah Arendt, On Violence. Any other. He found her, already seated at the coffee shop.
It's so nice to finally meet you.
He held out his hand. Bethany paused before accepting.
I'm Keith, he said,
once her fingers were wrapped in his, and laughed at himself.
Of course, you know that. I'm sorry. May I?
He gestured to the chair across from her. Bethany nodded, wondered why he didn't get himself a cup of coffee first.
No use in wasting time, so I'll just ask,
he said.
Have you made a decision?
Bethany responded honestly. She shook her head.
Good. Then I can still convince you.
Keith scooted his chair forward.
I know it's a family heirloom, but if you keep it locked away in storage, what difference does it make if you technically own it or someone else does? If you sell it to me, you can visit it. I can loan it to you. We could even agree that you can buy it back at any time.
Bethany wondered why it mattered so much to him. That he wanted it so very badly made her want to refuse him the satisfaction. How much are you willing to pay? She asked.
Keith blinked rapidly. Well, we discussed $50,000.
Bethany frowned. She had learned to do this during negotiations of any kind. Keith filled his lungs.
But I'm prepared to go up to $75,000.
He looked down at her coffee cup now, ready to wait for her response. Would you get me a refill? She asked. She enjoyed this power. She held it tight.
Keith jumped up. Of course.
She could feel his relief at stepping away. He ushered her mug over to the counter and asked the barista for a cup of his own as well. She watched him closely as he pulled out a few bills. She examined the repetitive wear of his wallet on his back pocket. She noticed the bevel of the outside heel of his shoes, evidence of uncorrected supination and thriftiness. The money he offered her could be better spent. When Keith returned, he looked expectant, hopeful the delay might have delivered a verdict. He sipped his coffee.
I'm happy to answer any questions, he smiled.
Bethany found the way he forced himself to keep his gaze on her willful. She respected his determination and broke eye contact herself to see his index finger fidget the cuticle of his thumb, torn raw and red.
Or maybe I can ask you a question, Keith said. What's holding you back? Why not sell it?
He lifted his mug to his lips again. Something about this query settled it for Bethany. I'm sorry, she said. No deal. Keith set his mug down a little too hard. Coffee rushed over the edge of the cup and ran down the tilt of the table into his lap.
Shoot, he said.
He ran to retrieve some napkins, wiping first at the splash on his pants and then mopping at the edges of the mug on the table. Bethany didn't move or speak. When Keith finally resettled, he said,
Why?
Bethany looked into Keith's eyes for the answer, but all she turned up with was the realization that she didn't need to explain it to him. She felt her shoulders flinch, as if the decision mattered little to her, no possibility of reversing it.
There's nothing I can do to convince you.
She shook her head and tightened her lips. Keith stood, a ball of wet napkins clenched in his fist.
Okay, he said. You know where to find me if you change your mind.
Blood swamped her heart.
Have a good afternoon, then.
Keith turned away, but spun back again.
I don't have it, but if I'd offered $100,000, would that have made a difference?
He asked. No, she said. She held out her hand, hoping to end the conversation as it had begun, before she remembered the wad of napkins. She placed her palm back on the table.
Then Why? All right. Thank you, Joanne.
Adrenaline rushed behind the name Joanne, but Bethany maintained her composure. Keith walked away with purpose. He pulled open the door, and Bethany watched through the window as he disappeared right, then crossed back left, changing his mind about where he was headed or unfamiliar with the neighborhood. Bethany wondered what it was Keith had wanted. She wondered what Joanne had to give. She wondered why she felt like it was her place to decide for both of them, but it had all unfolded so easily. She took a last sip of her coffee and gathered her things. A woman in a polished pantsuit walked through the door, her eyes looking for someone. She asked at the counter about the man whom she was supposed to meet. Bethany let her fingers fall on the shoulder of the woman as lightly as possible and leaned in. Joanne? The woman's whole body pursed under Bethany's touch. Keep it, she whispered. Delivery. When the first printer showed up, we almost refused delivery, so certain were we it was a mistake. We opened the box to find a receipt from the shopping channel that plainly displayed Mother's name.
I didn't order this, she exclaimed,
and we believed her. She didn't even know how to turn on the computer, so why would she order a printer? In the payment field of the bill, we saw that the QVC charge had been submitted through our cable provider. We wound up our faces in confusion, ready to retape the box shut, when we thought to check with Dad, just in case. Pausing at the bottom of the basement stairs, we said, Dad, did you order this? The blank look in his eyes said a lot, but we read it as a distractor, not the answer itself.
I might have, he said, taking the receipt from us. That's a good deal.
He pointed at the old linoleum table, recently relegated to the basement because of its solid wood successor now looming in the kitchen. We placed the box on its surface. When the video game system showed up the next week, we went to Dad first. You ordered a Wii? The two of us asked. He had been an early adopter of Atari back in the 70s, but he'd abstained from purchasing another system since then, sticking instead to his collection of board games, and then moving on to SimCity, Doom, Myst, before settling into the mundane game suite included with most PCs. We did not think of him as a video game kind of guy.
A wee bit of what?
He said, laughing at his own dad joke. A Nintendo Wii, we said, and recognition blinked onto his face. He confirmed and went about plugging in wires and scanning through options on the screen. And for the next week, we heard the sounds of synthetic bowling rumble in the basement below us, until the day we brought down another box and saw that the system had been dismantled, its cords and plastic casings piled haphazardly back into the box in which it had been delivered. Why did you take it down? We asked, but he shrugged, eyeing the new box in our hands. We hadn't opened it this time. We recognized the name of the warehouse on the return label and ushered it to him directly. What's in this one? We asked.
Let's see, he said with a coy smile.
When we lifted out the 21-inch flat screen, it didn't seem like an unreasonable purchase, considering he'd set up the video game system on a tiny 10-inch box set. Will you set up the Wii again now? We asked. But he went back to his computer without answering us. He had never been talkative, and we saw a lack of response as advice that we should do away with our own verbal excesses. We told ourselves to mind our own business, so he didn't have to. He had trained us well. When the set of reading glasses showed up, he said they were a birthday gift for our mother, and we wrote off the weak prescription and the fact that her birthday was still months away as sweet mistakes. When the laptop came, we considered how old his desktop computer was and how easy this would be to carry from room to room. When the flip cam arrived, his first grandson was about to be born to the sister who had moved away, and so we could understand that, too. You caught the shopping bug, huh? We joked with him, and he'd smirk like he had a secret. In reality, we blamed the purchases on his boredom. newly retired. At a loss for how to fill his time, he had developed an interest in electronics. In the beginning, Mother embraced his shopping.
"Let him do what he wants," she said, recognizing that he'd worked long and hard on his end of their partnership, the breadwinning.
When it didn't stop after a few weeks, though, she saw her spending power threatened by his advancing proclivities. When the coin sets started showing up with retail values listed high above their denomination, she asked him to explain what made them special. He turned away, as if he didn't owe her an explanation, and she knew it. She had always been the shopper in the family, and for every one package delivered to him, three others waited on the front porch addressed to her. A new dust ruffle, a fresh white jean jacket, a glass seashell with a bronze mermaid perched on the edge. Each item decorative rather than functional. She paid the ever-expanding cable bill each month with a wince, but penned the check to MasterCard with a righteously smooth hand. The shape of the next box seemed familiar, but there had been so many boxes, who could remember for sure? When he opened it up, we said, "Another printer?" It was a duplicate of the one he'd purchased just weeks before. "It must be a mistake," we said. "We'll send it back."
"No," he said. "I ordered it. Don't take it away."
"Why would you order a second identical printer?" we asked.
"None of your business," he said.
"What will you do with it?" we persisted, but he turned back to his game of spider solitaire on the old desktop computer, the laptop still untouched in its box. When the second video game system appeared, we considered not showing it to him at all. "Did you order a second Wii?" we asked from the top of the stairs.
"What?"
he called. "There's another Nintendo Wii here," we said. But he didn't answer, and one of us was tasked with taking it back to the post office. When the third Wii showed up, we grew concerned. We called QVC, and while we were on hold, Dad walked through the kitchen, saw the open box, and carried it downstairs without comment. The customer service representative came back on the line and said each system had been ordered through the cable box on different dates. It was as simple as pressing some buttons. We asked the cable company to disable this feature and waited for Dad to realize and complain. But he never mentioned it.
"Is he getting drunk and forgetting?" we asked Mom, but we found no empty liquor bottles in the trash cans.
The beer fridge remained stocked with the same 12-pack of lager that tasted flat and flavorless when we poured them into pint glasses for visitors. It was around this time that he started disappearing behind the wood panels in the walls of the basement. He pitched out our old Fisher-Price playhouses and trash bags full of stuffed animals, all frosted with mold and the singed yellow of cigarette smoke. We balked, but we also knew we were too old to put up a fight. We had a yard sale. Sure, someone would love the three-legged cat toy or the Lego sets with pieces missing, but the only profit we turned was from the Country Time lemonade we portioned out into Dixie cups. The pine cones we idly plucked from beneath the jagged skirt of our yard's only shade, and the complete collection of our childhood ceramics, sold to a suspicious young man with a neck tattoo, who we speculated might take a sledgehammer to them on YouTube. We dropped the rest off at the Goodwill, but we noted the look on the face of the volunteer taking the donation, resigned to hauling the bags out of sight until our car pulled away, and then pitching them into the dumpster out back. An act of generosity we felt guilty to require of him. After the secret storage compartments were emptied out, we found Dad setting up facsimiles of the basement in the cramped closets behind the wall panels. The first duplicate bore a modest resemblance to the rest of the basement. A rolling filing cabinet held a TV and the third Wii Dad had spirited away. A small TV tray table hosted the coins of which he'd purchased two sets. A canvas director's chair stood in for his recliner. He'd found older versions of our school pictures that hung on the walls beside his desk and tacked those into the drywall. The light of the closet's single bulb burned warmer than the cold fluorescent fixture installed in the main room. In the second compartment, the old cathode TV and a fourth Wii, we hadn't even seen arrive, sat propped on an old fruit crate in front of a dented metal folding chair. On a cardboard box turned on its end, a single Wisconsin quarter, the third he'd purchased, shined with its erroneous extra leaf stamped onto the tail side. Instead of photos on the walls, he'd sketched our likeness onto pages of the free notepads he'd accumulated from banks and auto repair shops, our faces misshapen, optimistic, unaware of our forced endorsement. "You might be losing it," we joked, but alone in our rooms, we thought of the way he'd imposed our faces on the paper, about what possessed him. One summer afternoon, checking our email on his old desktop machine, we noticed his checkbook left out beside the computer, flipped open to a random page. We eyed the numbers, casually, surprised to see as much money at the ready as there was, but then our eyes caught. Two checks to the gas company for the same amount, written a day apart. We paged down and saw three debits to cover the property taxes and four equal payments made in the same day for our technologically spiked electricity. We were afraid of embarrassing Dad, and so we took the checkbook quietly up to Mother, while Dad dozed in the family room.
"What's the meaning of this?" she hollered, waving the register in Dad's face. "Why on earth are you paying bills more than once? Quit it, would you?"
We offered to write the checks for a while. It would be good practice for us before we went away to school. Mother could even proofread our work. But she waved us off.
"You're going soft in retirement," Mom said to Dad. "You need to keep better track of this stuff."
We were starting to get the idea that maybe he wasn't aware of what he was doing, but our mother thought he was doing it on purpose, running down their accounts to teach her a lesson about her own spending. When fall came, we'd walk into the room and Dad would say,
"Where have you been?"
We'd say we'd been to the store or for a walk or just reading a book in the other room.
"I haven't seen you all morning," he'd say,
and we'd insist we'd eaten breakfast together.
"I didn't have breakfast," he'd say,
and we'd remind him of the bagel with cream cheese and hard-boiled egg.
"It must have been your other dad."
That grin would show up, and he'd stop talking. We hoped he was kidding, but went down to the hidden passages in the basement to look for a second or third dad all the same, just to be sure. One afternoon, he went out and didn't come home until the next morning. When he did reappear, his shirt rumpled and his face unshaven, he shook out a ragged cough and lay down. A deep scrape dented the driver's side of his car.
"Where were you?"
we asked.
"What do you mean? I was at home," he said,
appending.
"With my first wife."
Of course, our mother was his first and only wife. This was his favorite joke, but today we paused before laughing. As quickly as he multiplied, though, he divided. We asked him to walk to the ice cream parlor, just four blocks away, but when he got halfway down our street, he insisted we turn back, out of breath, weak, unable to go any farther. At restaurants, rather than ordering for himself, he looked at our mother with confusion and trust in his eyes and told her to pick what he might like. When we got in the car to head to his brother's house, he asked us which way to turn. We realized that what had looked like an expansion was in fact a breaking down. What we'd ignored in increments had grown too large to control. When the doctor saw him, he pitied the poor care Dad had taken of himself. But it was us who had not been mindful. It was us who had let him go. We hid the keys to the car, and eventually Dad stopped asking for them. We wrapped up old coins and pretended they were being delivered anew, and Dad delighted in them all the same. Once the utility bills had caught up with the credits on the accounts, Mom started paying them herself. In the basement, while Dad watched reruns, we tried our hand at his favorite computer game, Spider Solitaire. We assembled the two decks of cards in order as best we could, but the blind stack wouldn't reveal what we needed to run all the cards off the table. And so we took our chances again and again. Finally, we uncovered the card we needed, and the light stuttered from the screen as the cards danced around the virtual green felt tabletop in victory. From behind the wall panels hiding the replicas of the basement, we heard two more TVs playing the same channel displayed beside us, the sound of one falling just after the other, like sloppy dominoes. We heard Dad laugh, and then we heard Dad laugh, and then we heard Dad laugh. Strange loop. John slit the squirrel down the belly. He pulled out the stuffed sausage of inner flesh. It was rare he saw blood leak onto the table, so precise were his shushing slides of the blade. When he was working like this, the time went powdery. He rejoiced in the distracted exactitude. John was a frame of madly hung trouble, but he had found a hobby that suited him. Hypnotized by the ziplocking of animal skins around wood-wool forms, he created cradles for everlasting souls. He tendered their permutations with abandon. He doubled the undone. He cringed at the idea of fauna allowed to empty by time and science. He filled the dark corners of these dancing beasts. His hands remembered the weight of each animal as he lifted it onto the table for the first time. He could lock in to that perfect moment of communion. More than the death boarded up within each creature's skin, he felt a vacated life. John walked to the chapel alone in the mornings to pray and give thanks. He loved the moment the sunrise tipped through the windows onto his face, like an answer. He looked forward to this private stretch of time, to this unbroken focus. John was thankful for having been restored to usefulness in the open world, free from the sparse room he'd inhabited for the past 8 years, free of the aggression of the other inmates, free to season his food to his liking. It was true he could feel eyes on him when he visited the grocery store or bank, which made him wonder if people knew. But he did his best to soldier on. He made children invisible to him and pretended women didn't exist. Even despite the lining of sorrowful repentance, the liberty washed over him regularly, reminding him of relief and regret at once. John enjoyed hollowing snakes the most. He understood the symbolism, temptation, evil, baseness. But cramping the snakes' bodies into tight coils allowed him to imagine potential. He imagined the poison, and then imagined it being sucked out of him. He imagined his body rushing blood to the swollen site, the skin pulsing with rejection. He imagined the comforting constriction as the snake pushed out all of his stale air, making him pure and still. In his mind, serpents could compose a braille of salvation on his body. He felt a solidarity with the reptiles. He felt compassion for their status. John had found a clubbed rattler along the wooded highway one morning, and decided to make it his own. He stored it in the freezer for a couple weeks while he finished the squirrel. His fingers stuck to the skin when he pulled the snake out of the freezer, and he let it thaw in the vegetable crisper. He made his own molds now. When he'd started, he'd ordered them from a taxidermy supply company, but after looking at the shoddy construction, he decided he could very well make them himself by carving thick foam bricks from the hobby shop in town. He pulled the fangs and the teeth from the mouth of the snake carefully with the vice grip. He knew, from his reading, that the venom that burst from these wounds could remain lethal for years after the snake had died. There were times when he felt lightheaded from holding his breath with concentration, and instinct told him to worry it was the snake's toxins acting in revenge, to tread lightly, to be aware. John selected the manicure scissors from his tray and cut an even split from the vent at the base of the tail, working up to the neck. A snake was either mostly neck, mostly tail, or all abdomen. He couldn't help but fixate on how it didn't matter. He worked his fingers around, peeling the meat from the skin. Occasionally, he turned his head away, forcing himself to forget the trembling urges he kept in check. He trusted in himself and clipped carefully around the mouth, nose, and eyes, a silky slowness to the work. His mind erased the world above the basement, full of bells and smiling ladies, stinging secrets, last rites, sleeping pills. He pushed out names rude with distance, buckling rage, tolerance. He focused only on separating lips from jaw, scraping excess flesh from rind. He pinned the hide to a board, careful not to stretch it. He waited. He applied oil. He waited. He spun the skin onto its back, applied oil, and waited again. He covered the skin in paper and placed a board on top, and waited. This went on for days, and while he was waiting, John knit protein powder into blended fruit. As he thought about how he didn't want to return to the version of himself who preferred the way the world looked with a scrim of alcohol over it. He checked his shop online and carefully packaged purchased pieces. He wrapped them in the expired free weeklies he retrieved from the library, sealed the boxes precisely with clear tape, labeled them neatly, and walked to the post office, where he greeted Armando by name, and Armando avoided eye contact. John told himself silently that it wasn't because Armando knew anything of his past, but just because Armando was shy or had too many customers to remember or was interested in maintaining an appearance of strength that didn't allow for small talk. Armando stamped the word fragile onto each box with a willful violence, and John took his receipt and walked home, where he'd look in the mirror as he washed his hands and pause, trying to strike a noble pose, like a historical portrait. He Googled shadow people again, but there was only so much to learn. He checked his inbox. He looked for free porn to watch that showed heavy breasts being clutched firmly by fingers with long nails, watching the claws dig into the soft flesh without breaking it, knowing limits, allowing his imagination to bridge the gap. And then he cleared his browser history. When all of the waiting was through, he brushed the skin lightly and watched as the scale covers flaked off. This was his dream, to do the same to himself, to lie flat and feel the locked-up shell of him come loose, to pull warmth from the earth when he couldn't make his own, to bundle up his ugliness and allow the world to thieve it from him naturally. He rinsed the skin delicately in relaxer to keep it moist and laid it down. He unspooled thick wire the length of the snake and snipped, securing the foam with glue. With a prayer, he slowly fit the skin over the mold of the head, placing tiny balls of clay into the eye sockets and securing the glass eyes. He packed insulation into the body cavity, sewing it shut as he went along with confident yet careful pulls of the needle. Just like that, he closed the same body he had opened. Thinking of this cycle, he decided to make one more change and fit the tail of the finished snake into its own open mouth. He applied glue where the rattle fit into the throat and let his eyes run around and around the circle, singing to himself silently. I am a problem without a solution. I am a question without an answer. I am a poison without an antidote. I will never know what it is I've done. The principal's ashes. On the first day of school, the teacher thought only of the first day, not of the 179 to follow. As the students tip-tailed in, she looked each of them in the eye. Even if they didn't look back, she could see what she needed to see. Jonah would be the frog biter, the child capable of taking away a life. The class frog was sure to die before the end of the year because of Jonah not yet realizing that frogs were alive and capable of feeling pain. Mrs. Sayer had coined the term frog biter in 2005, when little Benny Baft had bitten off a frog's head in an epic tantrum about having to place his fresh set of crayons into the communal box. He'd broken a handful of the wax sticks in half, their soft paper wrappers peeling back as the crayons hit the floor, and then reached into the tank. Mrs. Sayer could have stopped it, but she was tired of cleaning the habitat each week. She watched Benny bite the frog's head off and then crumple with remorse. She picked up the body with a Kleenex and sent Benny to Principal Fleer, frog blood running down his chin. She'd get hell from the school nurse for not coming along to explain. Every year, this happened, sometimes more brutally than others. Bleach in the tank, stapling the frog's hands together, bringing the frog to gym class where he'd be crushed by a basketball. There was always a moment when Mrs. Sayer could have stepped in. But then what? Something else would assail the
Sample complete. Ready to continue?